Well, as I've said, this is the start of a very busy week in the life of the church. And there's much that's going on. Many things, as I've said, I think you're very familiar with, certainly Good Friday and what took place on that day. We talk about Maundy Thursday. How many of you are familiar with that term, Maundy Thursday? Some of you, not all of you. Thursday might have been one of the busiest days that Jesus had during that last week. The things that were taking place, the things that were going on. And yet Jesus' ministry of that last week began before that time. And as we look at what was taking place, there are always a lot of questions that people will ask about when things were happening. It's not critically important because you get people determining all types of different things with years and dates and all those types of things. But what is pretty well established is the fact that it's about this time of year, in the month that time was known as Nisan, or Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. It was the month around this March-April time period, which is why we celebrate that during this course. This was actually the time of year in Israel, in Jerusalem, that things were taking place. According to Exodus 12, because once again, and I've shared this with you in the past, everything that took place in Jesus' life took place for, number one, a purpose. There was purpose in what Jesus did. Things just didn't happen arbitrarily. Things were going on that the Father had directed him to, but Jesus was also walking out prophetic words that were spoken about him. Now, here's some interesting things. And again, numbers, I appreciate that numbers can say pretty much whatever you want them to. So that's not my purpose. I'm not trying to establish something in that way. But the Bible has, and there are a number of different numbers that you'll see with this, but I'm comfortable in saying there are over 300 prophecies that were written about Jesus in the Old Testament, hundreds of years before he came. And I've read a number of things about this, how could it be that one man could fulfill all of these prophecies? Because you get questions about, was Jesus truly the Son of God? Was Jesus who he said he was? And when you look at the Old Testament and the way that things were written by the great prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Micah, even in the Psalms, you see them writing about this person that was going to be coming at some point in the future that was going to change the course of history. And Jesus did just that. You say, okay, Pastor Dave, you know, anybody could have done that. You can pretty much make up anything you want to in order to support what it is you're saying. Well, there have been some calculations that have been performed. And once again, I know, numbers, you can do anything. But the question was asked, and I get this from a book that was written by Josh McDowell. Any of you ever heard of Josh McDowell? Some of you may be familiar with him. His book is called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's a great book. And in that book, he says this. He said, what are the probabilities that one man could fulfill the prophecies that Jesus fulfilled? And so there are over 300, some say as many as 400, depending on how you interpret things that were written. But what they did is they took, at MIT, they did this study. Mathematical probabilities is what they are obviously into. And they said, let's look at the mathematical probability that one man could fulfill, not 300, not 200, not even 50, eight prophecies. Just eight prophecies that a one man could come and through the hundreds of years that these things were written could fulfill just eight of them. And some of them are that Jesus would be a descendant of David. Jeremiah wrote that 600 years before Jesus was even born. Prophet Isaiah said that he would be born a virgin 700 years before it actually took place. Now, can you imagine writing that one? Okay, writing a prophecy, I understand. But a virgin? Isaiah, come here. You can't have a baby if you're a virgin. It doesn't work that way. Isaiah writes this. Going to be born of a virgin. They also wrote that he would be born even in the specific city. They said he'll be born in Bethlehem. The prophet Micah wrote that 700 years before Jesus was even born. What are the probabilities that something like that could happen? Well, they did this study, and of the eight things that they took, in order for one man to be able to fulfill those prophecies, they estimated that it would be the odds of 1 in 100 trillion. Now, let me give you an idea of what that number is, 100 trillion. This is what it would be like. If you had 100 trillion silver dollars and you'd spread them out over an area the size of Texas, that pile would be 2 feet deep. That's 100 trillion coins. Now, take one of those coins at any place that you want to and mark with a big red X. Throw it back in the pile, somehow mix all that up again so it's all out like it was before, and take a man and blindfold him. Tell him he can go anywhere in the state that he wants to, blindfolded, have him reach down and pick up that red X'd coin. That's 100 trillion. So somebody looks at me and says, was Jesus truly the Son of God? Yes, he was. Absolutely. You say, well, Pastor Dave, you know, you're thinking right out of the gate, well, all of those things that the Bible said were true. I mean, that's what you're establishing the basis on. Absolutely. Absolutely. So many of the things of the Scriptures are being proven even today in archaeological studies to be factual. Well, why would it be factual in one place but not in another? Either you accept the Bible to be what it is or you don't. But I do accept that Jesus was the Son of God, without question. So the events that took place over this week are recorded in all four Gospels. They're recorded in the first three, which are called the Synoptic Gospels, which means side by side, because those three are very similar to each other. And then John comes along and he writes a Gospel that supports in many ways, but there's some variances in these things. Can I encourage you not to get too bent out of shape about those things, that they don't say exactly the same thing? Why? Well, you've got different people telling different stories. Paul and I could experience the exact same thing, and then when we told somebody else about it, it would be not the same. It would be very different. His perception, my perception, issues of time and all those types of things, how they judge time. So all four Gospels record these events. And this morning, what I want to do, you may have a new pastor next week. I don't know. I may fire myself after this. I'm not sure. I'm not going to preach. I'm not going to teach this morning. What I'm going to do is this. I want to share with you the events of this last week as a narrative. In other words, I want to share this with you as if I actually walked through that with them and experienced it with them. I'm going to do it in the second person. So I'm going to describe to you what it is that I saw as a part of that group about 2,000 years ago. And so here's something you're never going to hear me say again. You can put your Bibles aside and set them down. You'll never hear me say that again. And what I want you to do is just to sit back and just allow your mind to go back with me in this. And I want you to hear what it is that Jesus dealt with in that week leading up to his death, a death that he knew was coming. You know, a lot of times we know something's going to be coming in our future, and it often affects how we behave, doesn't it? Your demeanor might change a little bit. Let's say you're going to the dentist to get root canal. You're not exactly chipper leading up to that, are you? But I want you to see how Jesus was in this last week leading up to the crucifixion. I've been following Jesus around for probably about 6 months now. You know, it's funny because people think that it was just Jesus and 12 men. And in reality, there have been as many as 200 of us that continue to follow him. We have seen some amazing things. We've seen Jesus perform miracles. We saw some people raised from the dead. There's always people getting brought up that are either crippled or blind or struggling with something because they know that Jesus, all they have to do is just touch him. All they have to do is just come and let him look at them or just give a word and their lives are completely different. We've been in Galilee for a while and we've been heading down towards Jerusalem because the Passover is going to be coming up in about 10 days. And Jesus told us that we needed to be in Jerusalem to celebrate that with the other pilgrims. So we've been walking along the Jordan. We came into Jericho, a city that we all knew what had happened there a long time ago with Joshua, those walls that came tumbling down. And you know, it was funny because we came towards the city and there was a tree outside and we saw this man that had climbed up to the top of the tree. Looking at him, and I asked somebody, who's that guy? They said, oh, that's Zacchaeus. You don't want anything to do with him. He's a tax collector. And they're basically thieves because they charge all of this money for taxes that people are supposed to pay, but they charge more than we're supposed to, and they keep it, and they get rich. And I watched him up in that tree, and it just occurred to me as I was looking at him, wait a minute, doesn't Jesus have a tax collector in his group? One of those guys, Matthew, I think, is a tax collector. And we got close, and Jesus actually looked up and said, Zacchaeus, come on down. He said, I'm going to be going to your house for dinner. And a bunch of the leaders, a bunch of the people came up and said, Jesus, you don't want to do that. Don't you know who that man is? Jesus knew exactly who he was. As a matter of fact, I had seen this so many times with this man. It didn't matter the kind of people that were around us. Jesus loved everybody. These women that you wouldn't want to associate with, loose moral standards, prostitutes even, he loved them. Men that had been involved in all of these insurrections and the Roman government was trying to arrest them, Jesus loved them. Fishermen, shepherds, there were all kinds of people gathered around us, and Jesus loved every single one of them. And so he called Zacchaeus down, and he went and had a meal with him. We all just milled around waiting for Jesus like we always did. We never wanted to get too far from him. And we get to a town called Bethany. And at Bethany is the home of some really good friends of Jesus, a man that we had all heard who his name was because he was one of the men that Jesus had raised from the dead. This was where Lazarus lived, and Lazarus had two sisters, Mary and Martha, and we had heard Jesus talk about them. He loved them so much. He would often stay at their home with them. They had supported him financially in the ministry. We knew that the disciples had received gifts from them in order to make sure that they could do all it was that Jesus said they needed to do. And so we arrived at their house, and we just rested there for a while. And while we were there, I think it was the next day, we were having dinner, and Mary came over, and she began to pour oil on Jesus' feet. We saw people do this a lot with him. There was always people coming up and wanting to give him things, and people that were such great sinners, and they would just fall down at his feet. It took me a while to understand what that was really about, and yet always Jesus just continued to love them. So Mary came up, and she poured oil, and I heard one of the disciples off to the side, I think his name was Judas, said, I can't believe that she's wasting that oil on him. Why is she? We could sell that and give it to the poor. We could give that money away. Yet I came to find out later that actually Judas was the treasurer of this group. And yet what I didn't know was that there were many times that Judas would take some money out of the bag for himself. So I sort of questioned whether or not he was actually concerned about what this woman was doing. But they would do that all the time. And then we came into Saturday, and we've just been milling around. Jesus would come out and talk with us, but of course Saturday is the Sabbath. And so we rested on that day. We didn't go anywhere, we just waited. And yet we could tell something was stirring in Jesus. There was almost an anxiousness about him. He didn't look worried. I don't think he was afraid by any means. I didn't see that on his face. But there was just an expectation about him. And the next Monday, Sunday, or the next day rather, Sunday, we had gotten up and we were headed into Jerusalem. And on the way, Jesus got a small donkey and had it brought over to him. And I found out later that the donkey had never been ridden before. I was actually a little bit concerned because I knew that if an animal had never been ridden, the first person that got on, it wasn't always a smooth ride. And yet, as I should have known, that donkey, just like everybody else, that when Jesus got near him, there was just a sense of peace that came over them. And Jesus got on the donkey, and as we made our way into the city, I was shocked. The city was packed. Thousands of pilgrims are there, all coming to celebrate Passover, to give their sacrifices, the festival that was going to be taking place, so the city was buzzing. And Jesus rode the donkey in, and I didn't know what to expect, because I had heard that the religious leaders were after him. I had heard that he had upset a lot of people by the things that he'd been saying. He'd been actually arguing with the Pharisees, had been telling them, the way you're doing this is not right, it's not right according to my Father's kingdom. People were even talking about him claiming to be the king of the Jews, things like that. I knew they weren't happy. And so when we came into the city, I was a little bit concerned. And yet when we got there, crowds of people began to gather around him. And they began shouting. And I was later coming into the city, so I didn't hear immediately what was being said. But when I got there, I could hear them saying things like, Hosanna. That's a word of praise that you sing to somebody in leadership. They had these long branches, these palms that they had, and they were waving them and they were throwing them on the ground. It was like a royal possession coming in. And yet when Jesus came, it wasn't as if he was looking like he belonged there in a way that I am lording over you. Everything he did was in complete humility. Everything he did, you could tell, it wasn't about him, it was about the one who had sent him. And I didn't understand this fully until a later time when I had the chance to think back at all that I had watched, all that I had witnessed. But I knew that what was taking place there was very unusual. I couldn't understand it. I did discover something else, though. That today's date, Nisan 10, was the date that Jesus came into Jerusalem, was the exact same date that the people that had brought their lambs to the temple submitted them to the priest for them to be examined to make sure that they were pure before they sacrificed them. This is something that's been happening ever since Moses. Moses told them to do this, that when they were going to bring their lambs, they had to first bring them to the priest so he could make sure that they were spotless and without blemish. Well, today's the same day that they're doing that, and yet here comes Jesus even presenting himself to the people. I wasn't sure if I was really understanding that right, but it seemed to be too important to be coincidence. And so we spent some time in the city. We got back to Bethany. We rested that night. Jesus continually just loving on the people around him, always more coming, people leaving. The disciples always just sort of keeping watch to make sure everything was okay. And there was Jesus, the picture of peace and of love, standing among them. Monday comes. And it was a strange day, Monday. It was very strange. Because I saw something happen with Jesus that I had never seen before. I've been telling you about how peaceful he is, how loving, and that didn't change. But there were a couple of things that took place that I had to ask some people about it. We were walking along the road, and there was a fig tree that some of the disciples were talking about. And as we were walking, Jesus cursed the fig tree. Now, I didn't understand that. That didn't make any sense to me. Why would he point to a tree and curse the tree? And so we bypassed that and we kept going and we headed into Jerusalem. And Jesus, like he always did, went to the temple. He said, "This is my Father's house." I'd heard him call it that many times before. And as we got close to the temple, this being the week of Passover, there were lots of tables that were set up, and there were a bunch of men there selling animals to people that were coming in if they didn't have any animals for the sacrifice. They would sell them lambs. They had birds and all kinds of little things. All the things that were okay to sacrifice, they were selling them. But the thing that we all knew is that they were charging an exorbitant amount of money for this. They were making money off of the festival of celebration to God. And when Jesus saw this, a look came over his face that I'd never seen before. Again, it wasn't the look that we would normally get. He didn't look angry in the way we get angry. He didn't look like he was going to hurt somebody, not like we do. But there was a righteous indignation that just consumed him. And he took these strips of leather and used him as a whip, and Jesus went after these men. He's kicking tables over. He's whipping around, and I don't even know if he hit anybody. I don't remember seeing him do that, but you could tell he was very upset by what was going on, and so he kicked them all out. He threw every single one of them out of the temple, and I remember what he said to them. He said, "How dare you turn my Father's house into a marketplace?" Into a place where these things are happening. So we're walking out of Jerusalem back to Bethany, and I'm talking to the disciples going, "Have you ever seen anything like that before?" And they said, "No, we hadn't." And we're walking back, and we looked at the fig tree as we walked, and we passed that same one, and it was withered. It had shriveled because of what Jesus had said. Well, Tuesday, as you might imagine, guess who showed up coming towards Bethany? All the guys from the temple. All the religious leaders. All the Pharisees. Because, you know, they made money off of all of that too. When they would sell all of those things, they had to give a cut, a percentage of that to the priests, to the people at the temple. They were pretty unhappy at what Jesus had done. And so they came and they confronted him, and we were standing in the back just watching and listening. And every time they would confront him with something of accusation or asking him why he did the things that he did, he always answered them very forthrightly, but always in love. He talked about how the fact that the priest had rejected him as the Son of God was the reason that he had cursed that fig tree. For them to be able to see and to understand what it means not to embrace who Jesus is and who God is. And so he continued to teach us all that day. We listened, trying desperately to understand all of these things. There seemed to be a sense of urgency in him when he talked, as if he didn't have much time. Of course, I realized later that was exactly what he was dealing with. And so finally, the Pharisees and the leaders left. They went back to the temple, I assume. And we began to walk, the whole group of us, because anywhere Jesus went, we always followed. And we ended up at a place called the Mount of Olives. This was a place that Jesus had gone many times to teach. And he sat down, and everybody else sat down around him, and he began to teach. He began to preach about his Father, about the kingdom, about Jerusalem. He began to talk about how his heart was so heavy for his home, for the temple, knowing that the temple at some day, he said, was going to be taken away from them because of their unbelief. And he talked about that fig tree, that it was a representation of the glory of the temple being removed from Jerusalem. You know, it was funny. No matter where you sat when Jesus was talking, it always sounded like he was sitting right there. Like he was just talking to you. There were hundreds of us there. I don't know how many. But there were so many times when I felt like he was looking right in my eyes. We came back to the house. And Wednesday came, and Jesus didn't go anywhere Wednesday. We just stayed there at the house. We fellowshipped, we visited, rested. There were more questions that were being asked, and Jesus was sharing again the things that had taken place and just helping us to try and understand, but it was a pretty quiet day. And now I understand why. Because Thursday came. And I think Jesus knew that the day before that Wednesday was the last chance he was really going to get to spend with his friends. I think there was a sadness that seemed to be a part of him. Again, not like our sadness. It's different than that. But I could just see it in his eyes when I could get close enough to see him. And so on Thursday, it's time to get ready for the Passover meal. And once again, a woman came while we were eating and began to anoint Jesus' feet with oil. It's so strange. People just feel like they have to give him something. They feel like that they have to present themselves to him in a way, and they were always trying to come in. Whenever we were at the house, there were hundreds of people that were standing outside, and every once in a while, someone would break through and get to Jesus. And this woman came in and began to pour oil on him. But we began to make our way to Jerusalem. And Jesus told a couple of his disciples to go on ahead. And he said, I want you to get a room ready for me. He said, everything will be there. He said, we'll get everything taken place. I didn't get a chance to talk to these disciples. And as a matter of fact, I was a little bit disappointed because I had a feeling that when they went into this room to have dinner together, I wasn't going to be able to be there. He was just going to take his 12 disciples. And yet when it was over, I had an opportunity to talk to each and every one of them. And I said, please just tell me what happened in there. I didn't want to be left out, but I knew Jesus needed to be with those that were the closest to him. And every one of them said, "We cannot believe what we saw." They said they got up into the upper room. And they said they were eating the Passover meal together, very specifically according to what Moses had said they needed to do. And they said at one point during the meal, Jesus got up. Said he took off his cloak. He took off his outer garment. Said he tied a towel around his waist. And he got a basin of water. And he came around and he began to wash each of our feet. Now, in our culture, when you walk on the streets, they're dirt. There's animals that go there. There's all kinds of nasty things. And so when someone comes into a house, they'll often take off their slippers, but they still have the dirt of the road on their feet. And so the lowest servant, or sometimes the youngest servant, will be the one assigned to come and to wash off the feet of the visitor so that they were clean in the house. And so they might do that, but never anybody of standing, and certainly not our rabbi. Jesus should not be washing someone's feet. And he kept going around to each of the disciples, and he finally got to Peter. Big mouth Peter. Peter says, "Jesus, there's no way you're going to wash my feet." And Jesus said to him, "Peter, if I don't wash your feet, you can't have any part of me." Each of the men said, Peter then at that point said, "Okay then, if you're, that's the case, wash my hands, wash my head. Just wash all of me. If I can't be a part of you, unless wash all of me." And he finished washing everybody's feet, set the basin aside, got his clothes back on, sat down again. And then he began to explain why it was that he did what he did. He said, "This is how you need to demonstrate who I am to the people in your lives." He said, "If somebody wants to be a master, he should be a servant. If someone thinks they're the greatest, they should see themselves as the least." And see, this was so foreign to everything that we had seen from the leaders of our temples. These men walked around in all of this finery. They had these little boxes that they would put on their heads that they had the scriptures in. And when they prayed, you should have heard them pray. It was beautiful. But they would scream at the top of their lungs so everybody could see them. Jesus was telling his disciples, this is not how you're supposed to live. You need to live in humility. You need to live so that you are never at a place that you cannot serve your brother or serve your sister. So the disciples said they were still trying to understand what it was that Jesus was doing by washing their feet. But they said nothing then prepared us for what Jesus said next. Because as we were all sitting there, all of us that had been together now for almost 3 years, they said they started gathering. They said Jesus looked around the room and he said, "Tonight, one of you is going to betray me." Well, he said, we all just, he said, that can't be right. Talking to each other, saying, what in the world is he talking about? Have we not demonstrated our love for him? The fact that we would follow him anywhere. And so they began to say, is it me? Jesus, it's not me, is it? And so John, the one that was laying against Jesus, he was probably Jesus' closest friend from what I could see. He said, Jesus, who is it? And Jesus said, the one that I take the bread and I dip it into the cup, the one I hand it to will be the one that will betray me. And we were all sitting around the house outside this room. And all of a sudden, this man comes running out the room into the night. We found out later that he had given that bread to Judas, the very man that they had trusted to keep their money, the very man that had walked with Jesus from the very beginning. But each of the disciples said, as soon as Jesus gave him that bread, a change came over Judas. He looked completely different. And to be honest, I barely recognized the man that had run by me, but I just knew he ran out of the room. And so the disciples said, when Judas had left, they said, Jesus then, it was towards the end of the meal, they said he took some bread that was there on the table, and he broke it into pieces, and he blessed it, and then he gave it to each and every one of them. And he said to them, this bread is my body, which is broken for you. Now, we knew that Jesus had been saying now and again that he was not going to be with us very long. Certainly none of us outside of that room fully understood what that meant, but at least we thought the disciples did. And yet each and every one of them said to me when they came out, they said, that didn't make any sense. But he wasn't done, because then he took the cup and he blessed it and he said to them, this is my blood, the new covenant, he called it, that is poured out for you, for the forgiveness of sins. And he said, I want you to do this. I want you to eat this bread and to drink this cup, because he passed it around and they said all of them took a drink. And he said, I want you to do this regularly, because every time you do it, I wanted to remind you of what it is that's being done for you. And when they had finished that, they got up and they left the room. And I was glad to see them, because now I could be a part of it again. I hated hearing all of these things secondhand. I wanted to hear. I wanted to see Jesus. And so Jesus walked out and we all began to follow him. And we were headed down to this garden. And actually, I'd been there before, because Jesus had brought us there to pray many times. It was a garden at Gethsemane was the name of the place. It was pretty quiet. It was a big garden. So there wasn't anybody around. And so Jesus had told us to just sit. He just asked us to stay back. He took his 12 disciples with him. And they went in a little bit and he had them sit down. And then he took Peter and James and John, those three that seemed to be with Jesus more than even the others. And he took them a little bit further, had them sit down, and then he went off by himself. Now, I was a little distance away, so I couldn't hear what he was saying, but I could certainly see him. And I got to tell you, there seemed to be such anguish when he was praying. I'd never seen Jesus pray like that before. And he got done, and he came back to his disciples, and actually, I think they fell asleep, because they looked startled when he came back. And he rousted them up, he got the rest of the disciples up, and he was talking to them for a moment, and then he left them again and went back and prayed. And again, just very intense prayer. You know how it is when people are praying intensely for something. You can just see it. He got up, came back, and once again, they had fallen asleep. So he woke them up, went back a third time and prayed. And so we're sitting watching this the whole time, not really knowing what's being said, just knowing that Jesus is deep in prayer. And he came back after the third time, and the disciples were still asleep, but he didn't wake them. Because he had turned to look, and I followed his gaze, and I could see light coming from another part of the garden, torches that were being carried. And I saw soldiers, I saw Pharisees, and I saw a man in front of them that I couldn't quite recognize, but he looked familiar to me. And when they got closer, it was that same man that had run out of the room. It was Judas. He was leading these people to Jesus. Of course, now we were all up and around him, concerned about what might happen. And Judas went over to Jesus, and they talked for a brief moment, and then Judas gave him a kiss. And I thought to myself, well, good. Everything's been resolved. Everything's going to be fine. But as soon as he kissed him, some of the men grabbed onto Jesus. And Peter, who was close by, took out a sword, and I saw him swing, and he actually cut the ear off of one of the high priest's servants. And Jesus made him stop. And I didn't see it happen, but I thought I saw Jesus bend down, and I got to believe if he'd done like he did for everybody else, he probably took his ear and put it back on his head for him. That would be what Jesus would do. But as I looked around, once they grabbed onto Jesus, I noticed everybody scattered. They all took off. Even Peter didn't really stay right with Jesus. And Peter wouldn't tell me this, but when they came out of the upper room, some of the others had whispered that he had actually told Peter he was going to deny him three times before the night was over. Peter wouldn't talk about it. So they scattered and they took off. And over the next several hours, because now it's the middle of the night, we're tired, we're moving into Friday, early morning. Nobody's been to sleep. But I was able to follow that crowd that had Jesus from a distance, because they didn't know who I was. I could just sort of blend in with the rest of them. And I know that they took him to Annas, the high priest. And I know Annas talked to him for a little bit, and then they took him to Caiaphas, and then back to Annas again. So they question him three times. Now, I don't know a lot about Jewish law, but one thing I do know is that it's illegal to try somebody at night. That's an illegal thing to do. They weren't supposed to do that. And so Jesus is being questioned by all of these people. They keep asking him all the same questions. And I did find out later that both Annas and Caiaphas had pronounced Jesus guilty of whatever it was that they were accusing him of. We still didn't know. Early the next morning, they took him to the Sanhedrin, which was the ruling religious body. And they made Jesus stand before all of these very learned men, and they peppered him with questions. Some Jesus would respond to, some he wouldn't. From the outside, I saw one of the priests walk up and slap Jesus in the face. And the Sanhedrin said he was guilty. Well, they knew that they weren't going to be able to do anything with him until they got the Roman government involved. And so the next person they took them to was Pilate. Pilate was the prefect that had been assigned by Julius Tiberius, the emperor of Rome, to come to that land, to be Rome's presence there. He hadn't been there very long. And I could tell just by looking at him and from the things I'd heard other people say that he was a man that really wanted everybody to like him. He was trying to keep the Romans happy, certainly, but he was also trying to keep the Jewish people happy because he didn't want them to be rioting. He didn't want them to create an issue or a problem. Well, now Pilate has Jesus in front of him. And again, we're not able to stand close enough to hear what they said, but soon after Pilate was with him, they took Jesus out again. And through some people that were talking that were close enough, I found out that Pilate had said to Jesus, "There's nothing. What am I here for this guy? He's innocent. He hasn't done anything. If he's upset you about your religious things, then take care of it there. But he's not done anything in the eyes of the Romans." But they decided to take Pilate, or rather, they decided to take Jesus from Pilate, and they took him to Herod. Herod was one of the leaders of the whole province, over Galilee, actually. So he was even greater than Pilate was, and they took him to Herod, and Herod was all excited because he was going to get a chance to finally see this guy that they had been talking about. And so Herod would ask him, "Are you who you say you are? Are you the man that's been doing all of these things?" Jesus wouldn't talk to him. And they said Herod got very frustrated. They began to mock him, began to accuse him of all kinds of things. They actually took a purple robe and they threw it over his shoulders and made fun of him. "Oh yeah, you're the king." Jesus wouldn't say a word. But Herod got rid of him and sent him back to Pilate. And so now Jesus has been on trial, if you will, seven different times. Herod couldn't find anything wrong with him. Pilate couldn't find anything wrong. But the last time Pilate came, the crowds were beginning to get upset. They were beginning to yell things. They were beginning to get worked up. You could see almost a riot getting ready to start. And Pilate finally, it seemed like he maybe had gotten an idea. Because, you know, at that time, there have been traditions, and they don't do it all the time, but every once in a while, they'll bring out a criminal and they'll release him as a part of the festival. They'll absolve him of the things that he's done. And so what I saw Pilate do was he brought out this man by the name of Barabbas. And Barabbas was a lifelong criminal. I wasn't even from this area, and I had heard them talk about this guy, Barabbas. Always inciting riots, always trying to steal things. Just insurrectionist. So they kept him. He'd been in prison most of his adult life. And so they brought this guy out, and Pilate had Barabbas on one side and Jesus on the other. And I heard him say, "Who is it that you want me to release?" And I got to believe he was thinking, surely they'll say Jesus. They don't want this guy. But as I stood there, I listened. Unbelievably, they all screamed, "Give us Barabbas." Not one person said, "Release Jesus." Not even the disciples. And I saw some of them around me. They didn't say anything. And so they let Barabbas go. And then Pilate finally said, "So what do I do with Jesus?" And my blood ran cold when I heard people say, "Crucify him." "Crucify him," they screamed. this man, this innocent man who had done nothing but just love the people around him, who had done nothing but bring joy to people. He had taken this boy that had died and told the mother, "Don't worry, your son will live again." And you should have seen her face when her son got up. "Crucify him," they yelled. And Pilate did something that I'd never seen a Roman person do before, because Romans basically in their own minds could do no wrong. They were the law. But listen to what Pilate did. After they said that, Pilate got a bowl of water and he washed his hands in the water. And he said to everybody there, "I am not responsible for the death of this innocent man. He's innocent. Let the blood be on you for killing this man." And everybody said, "Yes, that's okay." But Pilate, being the good Roman that he was, he had Jesus beaten. They turned him over to the soldiers and they took him away. Jesus was exhausted. I could just see it. If you've never seen anybody beaten by a Roman, they take these long leather whips and they embed pieces of metal in them so that when you're struck with the whip, not only does it burn and hurt as you would expect, but when the man with the whip would pull it back, those pieces of metal would dig in and it would shred the flesh. And they beat Jesus with these whips. They took a big staff and they would beat him about the head and the face. They spit on him. They took these thorns, and these thorns were at least an inch, maybe 2 inches long, and they made it into this crown and they jammed it down onto his head. There was blood everywhere. When they brought him out again, I couldn't even recognize him. He didn't even look like the same man. His face was swollen. His eyes were nearly shut. He hadn't done a thing. He didn't do anything to deserve this. I knew it was about time for them to begin the crucifixion, because they usually did these things in the mornings to give the criminals time to hang on that cross through the course of the day. And so they were going to take Jesus, and the place they were going to take him was a hill just outside of the city called Golgotha. And literally that word translates into the skull. And they tied that cross onto Jesus and they made him walk, carrying the very thing that they were going to nail him to. After they'd beaten him, after he was exhausted, and he fell several times, they just kick him to get up again. Finally, they grabbed a man out of the crowd. They put the cross on him and let him carry it up the rest of the way. And we followed, we watched what was going on. I didn't see Peter. Peter was supposed to be there. And so when they got him up onto the hill, they began to prepare him to be crucified. And the Romans had perfected the art of inflicting the most pain on somebody without them actually dying. That's what crucifixion was. They would nail the hands or the wrists into the wood. And then the long part of the cross, they would have a block of wood that they would put the prisoner's feet on, and they would nail them to that, right through their legs. And then they would put him up, and he would hang there. Now, a lot of people used to think that you would die from crucifixion because of these injuries or because of the blood. Well, at some point you might, but most people that hung on a cross died from suffocation, because they would be collapsed in that position and they couldn't breathe. And the only way that they could breathe would be to press up on that block so that they could get a breath, but they didn't have the strength to do that. And then they would collapse back down again. And they would do this hour after hour after hour. I couldn't watch. I had to turn away sometimes. And yet, while he was hanging on the cross, I did hear him say some things. And it was always about someone else. He wasn't even thinking about himself. He wasn't cursing. I'd heard people curse the soldiers. I heard them curse God sometimes. I heard them say all kinds of things just so they could die quicker. You know what the first thing was Jesus said? "Forgive these people for what they're doing to me." don't hold it against these men that are hammering these nails into my body. He was thinking about them. And then he said to John, take care of my mother. Watch after her. Concerned about her. I didn't hear exactly what they said, but I saw him talking to one of the criminals up there. And he hung there. I checked later and I found out that they had begun the crucifixion at about 9 o'clock that morning. And as I watched, and I was watching the time go by, I thought, how much longer can he hang there? And when I realized that he'd been there for a number of hours, I wanted to hear what he had to say at the end. I know at one point he must have been praying because I heard him cry out, my God, my God. I heard that. But at the very end, it was around 3 o'clock, I heard him say, it is finished. Now I thought right away, well, he must be meaning that he's going to die now. And in reality, what I discovered was, is that those words, it is finished, are the same words that are used when someone comes up and offers back a debt that they owe. I owe this person money, I owe them for something, and when I come and I repay them, what that person will say to me is, it is finished, meaning it's been paid in full. Jesus hung on that cross, and the last words that he said were about me. He said, I've paid it in full. And then he died. Soldiers came around and they broke the legs of the criminals next to him because they were still alive. But then they walked over to Jesus. They could see that he was already done, already had died. And yet one of them came and they had this big spear and they jammed it into his side. Pulled it out again and blood and what looked to me to be water came flowing out of him all around the foot of the cross. Power of Jesus was such that he changed people's lives. And the reason I know that is because I watched Joseph of Arimathea, who was a Pharisee, one of the very people that Jesus had been saying, you're wrong in what you're doing. Nicodemus, another Pharisee. Both of these men, I heard later, had gotten permission to take Jesus down from the cross. Because, you know, usually they just left them there. Birds would come, animals. It was terrible. They would just rot. But they got permission to take Jesus down, and they took him over quickly, and they put him in a tomb because they had to be done by 6 o'clock because that was the beginning of the Passover. You can't touch a body after nightfall. So they had to hurry to get him put in, into the tomb. One other thing, though, that I discovered. Jesus died at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Going back again to Exodus, where Moses writes and tells the people about sacrificing their lambs for the Passover, they couldn't begin that until dusk. That was when the time of slaughter began of the lambs, to shed the blood for atonement, to be forgiven of sins. We recognize dusk as being from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. Jesus died at 3 o'clock. His blood was shed as the final sacrifice, the final lamb to shed his blood. And yet as I watched all of this taking place and I watched them carry Jesus away, there was something in my spirit. It just wasn't over. It couldn't be over. There had to be more to come. And as I turned and I left that place, I saw people weeping. I saw so many that had followed him. I tried to look in their eyes and to see if I could see what they were thinking or what they were feeling. And I saw a range of different emotions. I saw things from despair to hopelessness to just bewilderment. And yet there were a couple of people that I looked in their eyes and I could see they thought the same thing I did. This isn't done. This isn't done. Heavenly Father, I just thank you, God, again, for what it is that you have done for each of us. I thank you, Father, that you sacrificed your Son for us. They mocked him from the ground and they said, "Surely he saved others. Why can't he save himself?" And little did they know, Lord, that you could have called a legion of angels to come and to rescue you. And yet you stayed on that cross for me, for each and every person in this room. And I pray, Father, that even as we leave this place this morning, that we will have maybe a renewed understanding and an appreciation of what it is that you did for us, willingly sacrificing your life. And yet all through that time leading up to the very end, you never stopped teaching. You never stopped loving. You never stopped demonstrating the power of God. And so I pray, God, as we come together again next Sunday on Resurrection Day, a day of celebration, Father, it's only in knowing what it is that you endured that we can truly embrace the majesty of what took place on that morning. And so, Father, I thank you. I thank you, God, that you're here in our midst. I thank you again for each and every person here. And I pray, God, again, as we leave this place, may we show your love everywhere we go. Not just talk about it, but demonstrate it. Show people who you are at my place of work, at school, in the grocery store, wherever I am. Father, may they see you in me. Father, thank you. I pray blessing over each and every person here. Go with them. Keep them safe. And we look forward to being back again next week. It's in your precious Son's name that we pray all these things. And Remnant Life Church said, amen and amen. Well, God bless you folks. Have a great day today. Love one another a lot. Love people wastefully. As I said, if you've not left your tithes or offering, make sure you